This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
There's a number of topics that we could have gone through here, but we decided to try and keep it to just a few. But let me first of all remind you that Rebecca actually has a doctorate of philosophy. She teaches philosophy. She's written several novels. She's also written a wonderful book about Gödel, another one called Betraying Spinoza. She got a MacArthur Genius Award. And you can read all this somewhere else, but who are you really? I mean, what do you...
I think I'm somebody who wants to know everything.
Yeah.
Who am I really? I come from a very religious background. I think that probably was the most important fact about me, that I was born into a very Orthodox Jewish family. I come from 12 generations of rabbis, and my brother is a rabbi.
Oi.
Yes. Everything went wrong. I mean, I'm the black sheep of the family. I am, you know, the only one who has fallen away. And I blame it on Plato. Partly, but I encountered Plato very early. So in my family, you know, we kept the Sabbath very strictly, and we were also very poor. My father had come from Poland. He supported himself by being a cantor, and we didn't own any books. But before the Sabbath, every Friday, I was taken to the library to get the reading material. And that's basically all we did all Sabbath. And at a certain age, I think it was something like 11 or 12, I took out this book by Will Durant called The Story of Philosophy. And I think perhaps the first chapter was on Plato. And it was my first experience with a kind of ecstasy. I didn't understand very much of what I had read, but there was something about this notion of that there was beyond the phantasmagoria. I remember that was the first and last time I ever read that word. I went to my dictionary. It wasn't in my dictionary. I thought, wow, this is a really smart book. It's got words that aren't in the dictionary. But beyond the phantasmagoria is this ideal, beautiful world, something like mathematics. And I was a kid who loved mathematics. And I had to put the book down, you know, for a while till I could catch my breath. It made me so excited. And it was the thought that by exercising reason, we could somehow gain access to this world that would be the same for all of us, and that was thoroughly beautiful, and that we would leave the differences behind us. I mean, there was, at some level, I grasped this idea, and I found it very, very inspiring and very exciting. And I just wanted to, it inspired me to try to know everything I could.
Why Plato? Why isn't it Aristotle at the Google?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, of course, I have this close connection, you know, with Plato, since he first inspired me, as he inspired so many others, with his vision of reality, in which beauty plays such an important role. I believe that Plato created philosophy as it has continued to exist, that, as you well know, philosophy is divided up into many subgenres. For every area of human inquiry, human concern, there's a related philosophy of that area, philosophy of language, philosophy of mathematics, philosophy of science, particular sciences, philosophy of physics, philosophy of biology, philosophy of education, philosophy of history, philosophy of art, you know, philosophy of religion, just epistemology, political philosophy, ethics. So just everything that we're concerned with, there is a corresponding philosophy of. Plato, in some sense, I think, mapped out the landscape that he was in metaphysics and epistemology, political philosophy of art, philosophy of religion, philosophy of language, philosophy of mathematics. He asked the paradigmatic questions in these various areas of philosophy, And, you know, so as in terms of the question guy, you know, I think it's Plato and Aristotle and all philosophers afterwards are addressing the questions that were first raised by Plato. And to a large extent, he also develops the methodology, you know, this process of argumentation. I also love the way he writes. He's also a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
He lavishes tremendous beauty on the works of philosophy that he produces. He writes in dialogue form. And so as somebody who tries to straddle these two areas of philosophy and literature, Plato really means a lot to me as well.
So look, this book, in case you don't know, I'm just actually going to read from the Kirkus Review because it's the quickest potted thing I've found, although I've read a lot on this. As the author imagines, in Plato's an intense, curious visit from ancient Greece, who was touring the country to promote his famous tract, The Republic. He first lands in Mountain View, California, goes and speaks to goes to the Googleplex, gets a Chromebook, comes to love his Google Chromebook, and he cautions his enthusiasts that information is not the same as knowledge, so we get into a discussion about, so what is knowledge? Then he goes off and you put him on a panel at a 92nd Street Y to discuss child rearing with three other people. Then, these are all interspersed, by the way, these set scenes are interspersed with slightly more scholarly disquisitions about it, but immensely readable. I mean, this is a wonderful book. It just can't be read in an evening, that's all. but after the 92nd Street Y, he then takes a gig as a consultant to an advice columnist, a sort of...
what they call in England an agony aunt.
An agony aunt, yes. offering responses to queries about love and sex. He then does a stint on a cable news show with a host who's somewhat Bill O'Reilly-ish and forceful, who questions the whole enterprise of philosophy. And then finally he goes and has his brain scanned in an MRI, where he has to deal with... an arrogant, leering scientist in charge of a neurological research lab. And then we have the psychobabbling advice columnist and the egotistical cable news interviewer. I mean, what on earth were you thinking?
Well, one of the theses of the book, there are many, but one of them is that these philosophical issues, some of them identical with the ones that Plato first raised, but some of them further developments. And because I do believe, and this may be something we can talk about, that philosophy plays off of science, and that to be a good philosopher, you have to keep abreast of science. But what I wanted to show is that these questions are very alive, that we're talking about them when we're talking about how to raise our children, what we want our children to be like, what kind of lives we want them to lead. When we're talking about love and romance and sex, there are philosophical questions that Plato first raised. And certainly the area that you're involved in and that I'm interested in, the incredibly explosive brain sciences, the tremendous progress that we've made recently in our underlying physical nature,
right,
raises profound questions, further developments of questions that Plato first asked about personal identity, free will, choice, whether it exists, and that these are philosophical questions, and that... So that's what I was trying to do, in a way, bring Plato into our day by showing that these are questions, the kinds of questions that he first asked are still very present. And one of the things that the hardest thing about writing this book was that I pretty much committed the 26 dialogues to memory. So that or at least my favorite parts of them. And there are some dialogues I can't stand, but my favorite ones, the Timaeus, the Phaedrus, the Republic, the Symposium, the Phaedo, I got a lot of favorites. But I wanted to really lift passages from, you know, so I'm writing these dialogues, but I wanted to lift passages almost verbatim from Plato and weave them in as seamlessly as possible as a way of trying to demonstrate that these are, you know, that he's here. He's in our dialogues. He's in our conversations. He's in our concerns. So that's something I was trying to do
so
the, in
the,
that
the,
madness.
The advice columnist gets, here's one letter. Dear Margot, I've always been a girl who likes bad boys, and now I've found a bad boy who breaks my heart on a regular basis. He cheats constantly with other girls, married women, guys, for all I know, with fresh fruit. He never lies about it, never apologizes, and it goes on side.
Yes.
I don't. And we're talking about VBBs, very bad boys. Now, you have her answering, and then I was curious whether Plato had something philosophical to add on to this.
Yes.
And here it comes. Strange to me was it that even the best person whom I've ever known, a person whose inner moral voice spoke so clearly that he passed through his life without ever committing a great wrong, even such a one as he fell victim to a VBB. I think you put VBB in there. I'm not sure Plato wrote that, did he? Right.
Yes.
So what she's doing is taking these writings and putting it into these strange situations, which are in fact timeless, as you're claiming, right?
They are. And of course, the person to whom Plato is referring there is Socrates, that Socrates fell
yes.
victim to the very bad boy, Alcibiades. And, so here's another thing. We know so little about Plato, the man. He's very remote
right.
from us. And it's not just a matter of his having lived 2,400 years ago. It's the way he wrote. He keeps himself out. He brings many of the characters of his day, first and foremost Socrates, to life. So we know an awful lot about Socrates and about Alcibiades and other characters. But Plato, that man, is very remote. And so I want to, whenever I write about philosophers, Spinoza or Plato, I want to try to imagine my way closer to what they might have been like. And one thing I think we know quite a few things about Plato. We know he was an aristocrat, and we know all sorts of things about him. One thing I think we know about him is that he truly loved Socrates. And so love is very, very important. And part of the erotic impulse is very, very important in Plato and in philosophical dialogue. It's a very personal relationship. It's a very intimate relationship.
But just gloss this a little bit for people who don't read philosophy. How did this arrangement? What does the literature say about how we ended up with Plato being the one that's best known and is effectively, I don't quite mean this, but,
yes.
but writing notes based on what Socrates was saying, and very elegantly, but isn't that Socrates' thoughts?
Oh, heavens, no. No. It begins with Socrates, but here's another reason that Plato is really interesting. You can see the development, the evolution, the struggle, the conflict as it develops over the course of his very long life,
mm-hmm.
His very long philosophical life. He died, 82, 80 something. I mean, the Greeks lived a long time, that Mediterranean diet. But he puts forth ideas, he tries them out, he criticizes them, he takes them back. I almost gave, where was I speaking? I think in London, at philosophy, to a bunch of philosophers, and I almost gave them apoplexy by saying that I do not believe that Plato believed in the theory of forms, that he tried, and that's the thing that we most associate Plato with, you know, the view that besides, you know, this particular water bottle, there is a Platonic form of bottleness and waterness and, you know, these abstract forms that exist. Plato tries that out. It's worked out in the Republic. It's certainly in the Phaedo. But He subjects it to great criticism in the Parmenides, and then in the later dialogues, although there's controversy over how you date these things, but in, for example, the Timaeus, they just disappear, the form. So I think you can see after Socrates' death, he died in 399 BCE, and Plato had really begins his philosophical career then. And he was planning to go into politics, but then he was so disgusted with the Athenian democracy for putting the best man of his day to death, Socrates, that he gave up on the idea of politics. This is another thing that we know, and devoted himself to philosophy. So you can see all of this development and this opening up of this vast philosophical terrain post Socrates. And so it's due, I would argue, to Plato and his amazingly active philosophical mind. He had such a nose for the philosophical question that he sniffed it out, in all these different areas.
I was being a little provocative there, as you well know, because there's an analogy that you yourself make there. Here we have Shakespeare writing such a... And all these challenges about who Shakespeare was, whether he was really known. And here we have a similar situation where Plato is not really terribly known as a being.
No, he's not. I mean, there are these letters that he wrote. There's a lot of controversy over whether they're authentic or not. When I was a graduate student, I'm not trained as a classical philosopher. My first area was philosophy of science, philosophy of physics, because I come in from the sciences, and but I did have the opportunity to study with the greatest Greek philosopher of his day, Gregory Philostos at Princeton. In those days, it was everybody accepted that the seventh letter that gives us a lot of information, if it's veridical, about Plato's life, everybody said that it was apocryphal. And now, when I was coming back, revisiting this, people have changed their minds. A lot of people think that it's... if Plato didn't write it, then somebody very, very close to him wrote it. And that gives us a lot of information about Plato. And it was from there that I was quoting when I said that Plato had planned to be a politician as somebody from his class would have been. He was, a descendant of Solon. He was a very upper class Greek. And but he was revolted by both the oligarchs and the democracy when it reinstated itself after the Peloponnesian War, because it voted to put Socrates to death. And so, we owe the creation of philosophy to this turn of events.
But go back in your own life. You actually had a huge interest in physics. I mean, that was your...
Yes.
So
yes.
Science was your primary... Where did that come from?
Again, I go back to that White Plains Public Library. It was really... That was the place that, everything went back to that. But when I was quite young, I took out a book called Our Friend the Atom, and it blew my mind. It just blew my mind that there was, again, this notion that there's a reality out there. It's that same thing. It still kind of blows my mind and raises goosebumps, that there's a reality out there that is so very different from what we apprehend, and that we can somehow reach it through being really, really smart and working very, very hard and working together. This time it wasn't these Platonic forms, but it was these, that there are these little things, colorless atoms, whirling around in empty space, and that's what's really out there. And I just thought, that's amazing. How can people know this? And there are these people called physicists who discover this. And my great ambition was, it wasn't even clear that I was going to go to college. I came from a very orthodox family. But my greatest ambition was that I would someday meet a physicist and be able to ask them, how do you know this? How do you get outside your head and know what's really out there? But when I finally did get to college, that's what I wanted to study. Because I'm really interested in, as I think you are, as I think everybody in this room is what is the nature of reality? What kind of universe do we find ourselves in?
Well, you married a physicist to begin with, anyway.
Yes. So. Yes. Yes. My first husband, Sheldon Goldstein, is a physicist. Yes.
Yeah. But you start with the science, and then we have a piece here where you're writing about what you call philosophy jeerers. And then we also have, as a result of so many disciplines now relying upon neuroscience, so that it's become a prefix for neurolaw, neuroethics, and people now have been calling it neuroporn because it's just everywhere. So there's this slamming of the neuroscience from some directions. There's, you think, a war going on here between scientists and philosophers. I mean, in the Guardian piece that they did about you, it actually starts, for some time now, the discipline of philosophy has been under something of an assault from the world of science. 4 years ago, Stephen Hawking announced that philosophy was dead. He was referring specifically to the philosophy of science, which he said was still bogged down in epistemological questions from which science had moved on. But philosophy in general has increasingly been viewed as irrelevant by many scientists. It's a perspective that may be best summed up by the cosmologist Lawrence Krauss, who said science progresses and philosophy doesn't.
I just disagree with absolutely everything that was said there. I mean, where to begin?
Have you told him that? Have you had this? I mean, in your discussions with...
I've never actually met Stephen Hawking, but Lawrence Krauss and I have crossed swords. Yes, yes.
But are you having any luck with the philosophy jeerers or what?
Oh, and then of course Atkins. What's his first? Peter.
Oh, Peter Atkins.
Peter Atkins. So you know, when I was speaking in London, he made sure to sit right in front, right up front, and you know, And so I decided extemporaneously I'm going to talk especially on this ridiculous war between that some scientists want to make on philosophers. We are joined at the hip, philosophers and scientists. But anyway, so there I was, you know, sort of just talking my heart out. And Peter came over afterwards and he said, that was really good. And I said, did I convince you at all? He said, not at all. So, not at all. But anyway, so, first of all, Stephen Hawking, in his last book, an excellent book, except for what he has to say about philosophy, goes on and does philosophy of science. And I would say not particularly well. But the question of what it is that we're doing in doing physics, for example. Are these descriptions of reality, are we not expanding our ontology? Are we simply making predictions? Does one have a more Kantian view that one is exploring the categories by which we organize experience, which seems to be something that Hawking argues there. What it is that we're doing when we're doing physics isn't answered by physics itself. And, and to be a physicist is to have a view about this. Are we actually discovering things that exist, even though they're non-observable? What are the requirements for something to be a scientific theory? Is the multiverse, is string theory, is this a scientific theory? These are philosophical questions. Science can't avoid raising philosophical questions. And then there are philosophers who can make the distinctions and point out the various points of view, argue for one rather than the other, see the inconsistencies that people often espouse in putting forth their views. So there, it's a different. What is science? Science is this wonderful methodology that we wandered on. Took us long enough, but it's this wedding together of a priori mathematics and observation and testing and experiment. It's this incredible methodology that we worked out that gives reality a chance to answer us back when we're getting it wrong. That's an incredible thing that we wandered on, you know, and really comes in the 17th century. It's really Galileo who puts it all together and Newton who takes it further. We were bogged down on all that Aristotelianism before. But not every question can be answered that way, including the question of what exactly is it that we're doing? Are we discovering something about reality, or are we simply, does it all take place within the category of our experiences? Are we just predicting further experiences? And scientists themselves disagree about this. The famous debate, the great debates that were opened up by quantum mechanics and the conflict between Bohr, Niels Bohr, and Einstein, those famous debates, was very much a question about, you know, what is it that we're doing when we're doing science? Are we realists? Do we think that we're actually discovering things about the world, or are we not? Einstein was a very strong realist, and Bohr was not. So scientists themselves disagree on this fundamental philosophical question. So there's no way to avoid philosophical questions.
Right, but what is philosophy actually? Just playing devil's advocate.
Yes, please.
What is it actually doing? I mean, you have your Dr. Schockert character at the end, who's doing the MRI, and I can't find the exact quote, but he's essentially saying that when a discipline is in its infancy,
yes,
philosophers can say all sorts of stuff,
yes,
and that's great and that's fine. But as soon as the scientist squad comes in and starts adding data,
yes,
then at some point you just retire the philosophers.
They're retired, right, yes.
Done that. Thank you.
And certainly,
do you have another problem for us? Thank you.
Yes. Certainly in the history of our epistemological quest here, it certainly is often been true that philosophers first, you know, asked the questions and they argued about it, and then the empirical sciences caught up and gave us answers. But that is not all, and philosophers are very, very useful in doing that. You know, science used to be called natural philosophy. Physics was part of philosophy. Mm-hmm. There was natural philosophy and moral philosophy. Psychology was a branch of philosophy, and as it matures, yes, it breaks away. But that's not all that philosophers are doing. If you conceive of philosophy as being in competition with science in telling us what is, then philosophers are a pack of fools. If philosophers are seen as competitors here, we're going to argue about the nature of reality, whereas scientists are going to use this amazing methodology that has been hammered out, often because philosophers' input. But here we have it, this methodology that gives reality a chance to answer us back when we're getting it wrong. That's incredible, you know, it's a kind of humbling thing, you know, that we can argue and argue and use our intuitions, but reality has, nature has the last say, and that's what science is. It gives nature a chance to say, oh, so you think that simultaneity is absolute, do you? You think that, you know, that's intuitively obvious, which it does seem to be intuitively obvious. Well, we'll just see about that. We're going to, you know, voila, you know, relativity theory, which makes predictions which were substantiated, and our intuitions have to be corrected. And that's, science can do that. But philosophy also can correct our intuitions. And philosophy can look at what it is that science is telling us and see which of our intuitions are compatible with it, which are incompatible with it, which are needed in order for science to proceed at all. So the way I conceive of a philosophy, and this is based very much on the ideas of Wilfred Sellers, who is a 20th century philosopher, and he wrote this article that I read when I was myself in great conflict whether to go on in physics or in philosophy. He has this article called Philosophy and the Scientific Image of Man. It was published in 1962, I think, but based on talks that were given in 1960. And he proposes there that we have two different images of us in the world. There's the scientific image of us in the world, and there's what he calls the manifest image of us in the world. Actually, he uses sexist language. It was 1962, so it's the scientific image of man and the manifest image of man, but I'm correcting him. And and the manifest image of us in the world is these other intuitions that we bring to bear in trying to make sense of the world and us in the world. So intuitions about, well, even intuitions about what makes for a good explanation, which is needed in order for us to be able to do science at all. Intuitions about evidence, about logic, intuitions about personal identity, about the nature of time, all sorts of intuitions and moral intuitions as well. And that what philosophy tries to do is to reconcile these two images, the scientific image and the manifest image. Some of the manifest image is absolutely necessary in order for there to be science at all. Some of it is undermined by science, and some of it is compatible. It's a kind of maximizing of coherence, using science, but our other intuitions as well. And I'm particularly interested, and in this book, I'm particularly interested in the kinds of questions with which Plato began, because they were Socrates' questions, which are moral questions. And there, philosophers have, in fact, made progress. And I would argue that the kind of moral progress that we've made, and we have made moral progress, itself a contentious thesis, but one that I'm prepared to argue, was first prepared by philosophical arguments, examining certain inconsistencies in our moral points of view, that we would commit ourselves to certain positions when it involves us and our own kind, and that you can actually see in the course of intellectual, philosophical, moral history, the philosophers pointing out these inconsistencies. So take, for example, slavery. Comes up a lot here, because Plato, a great philosopher, a great moral mind, Aristotle, a great moral mind, never thought to question the institution of slavery, of the idea that you can own people. And Plato actually begins the process of questioning it, because he has an argument in the Republics, and again in the Republic, again in the Laws, that Greeks ought not to enslave other Greeks, even when they capture them in war, that you can't treat other Greeks that way. But the idea that his argument can't be universalized to non-Greeks, the idea that slavery might be wrong for what they call the barbarians, and barbarian simply meant a non-Greek, because bar is ancient Greek for blah blah blah, and to ancient Greek ears that's barbarian. What non-Greek sounded like, just blah blah blah, bar barbarians. The idea that it might be wrong to enslave non-Greeks, just it didn't occur to them. And it's by accretion, it's by cumulative argumentation that this idea of other people outside of your own kind mattering is introduced, because pointing out inconsistencies, that's what philosophers try to do. They try to see what entails what is inconsistent with what. That's why the argument is such an important tool. Scientists have their empirical means, and philosophers have the argument. And what an argument tries to do is tease out implications, see what's compatible with what entails what. And we've made progress by doing that.
All right, let me play the idiot again, just for which comes naturally. Let me just give you three or four instances, and you can comment on them. I mean, Kant's line about...
First open this.
The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me.
Yes.
What do you mean moral law within me? There isn't. Could be argued, given all the things that are going on now. Secondly, take utilitarianism. Right? Pretty frank, rigid utilitarianism all the way back to Jeremy Bentham. Give it to Peter Singer, and Peter Singer will write a book called Animal Liberation.
Yes.
And has continued with all this stuff.
Yes.
Still in a pretty much utilitarian position, getting a huge amount of attention and also creating a social movement.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. Yes.
John Rawls writes A Theory of Justice.
Yes. Yes. Mm?
He talks about the veil of ignorance and how you can fairly assess somebody's position, the original position and so on.
Yes.
It's a bit like Plato's cave, though. I mean, these are sort of thought experiments.
They are. They're thought experiments, yeah.
And they have huge impact, but they're not scientific.
Exactly. You've made my case for me.
Thank you.
Yes, it's exactly. You know, and it begins, you know, I'm not saying, Hume said that reason in itself is perfectly inert. So I'm not saying that philosophical argument itself can bring about this social change. But I think that what we see over the course of history, and it's very, very slow, and I wish it was faster, because there's still so much injustice in the world. But what one sees is, you know, this sort of, here's an inconsistency here. And, you know, John Locke had first, I used to think that John Locke had first said, here's an inconsistency here, the institution of slavery, but it's actually, it goes back before Locke, it's Montesquieu, and even before, 150 years before Montesquieu, there was Jean Bodin,
right.
Who has a very strong argument saying this is slavery is a morally incoherent position. And yes, he was ignored because, you know, it was the economy, this was, you know, so dependent on this. It would have really upset things. So he's ignored for a long time. But other philosophers, you know, examine the argument. And what finally happens, and I think it's, you know, it's one of the better angels of our nature, to quote the title of a very good book by Steven Pinker. One of the better angels of our nature is that if we don't really like inconsistency, and if we, our faces are really, you know, rubbed into it long enough, it starts to feel uncomfortable, and then our emotions start changing. And of course, you know, there has to be social activism. So philosophical argument is the seed that starts pointing to this kind of inconsistency and moral incoherence that we have. We compartmentalize. And it's, you know, it's pointing out that we're being consistent. It usually takes a long time because there's something to be lost, and the powers that be don't want to lose the powers that they have. But, you know, with enough social activism and enough, you know, a critical point is reached, and then things start changing. And it happened, you know, with slavery. It happens with women's rights. Right. It happens with, you know, children's rights. And we saw it in our day with gay rights, you know, still going on. You know, a moral incoherence, a moral inconsistency. And emotions start changing. And Peter Singer is a wonderful example. When Peter first started to write about, very philosophically, has a very good philosophical argument about the intolerable way in which animals are treated and ought not to be treated. You know, what was that, about 30, 35 years ago? I remember when he was starting to write it, and it all seemed a bit odd at the time. But, you know, he kept at it, and slowly, you know, there are social movements now, but also our emotions have changed about it. And so it's this process. I think Singer is a wonderful example, a philosopher putting forth philosophical arguments that finally gather weight and our emotions start changing. And so this is all the project of the Enlightenment, this idea of trying to, you know, sort of use reason, and it can be a moral force. I mean, Hume is right. It can't do it all by itself. Emotions have to be brought into it. But emotions never change themselves. Emotions are static. Emotions are conservative. If there's going to be change, it has to be through argument, through reason. And that's an important thing, that we've made progress. And philosophers ought to get some credit for that.
It's appropriate that, I mean, so you take something like the Brain Initiative. This happens to be a volume that's just come out, edited by Gary Marcus, The Future of the Brain. A lot of essays in here by people like Christoph Koch and the Nobel Prize winners from this year, Olaf Sporns, the two Mosiers, as
right.
I was saying. But there is also in here an essay by Ned Block. And what he's basically looking at is consciousness, big science, and conceptual clarity. And this is not the place, I can't go into it all here, but he's basically acknowledging that, or claiming that the theories of consciousness that are currently out there, global workspace theory and all the various other ones and so on, have not been thought through clearly. And he has some interesting suggestions here that come from having studied the data that has come in so far.
Yes.
And it's a very good paper. It's a very good essay. So
yeah, he's a very
plainly
good philosopher.
There's a point at which now, where we're still talking about consciousness and free will and so on, that the debate should be one in which they're joining.
Oh, absolutely. And so, Stephen Hawking had charged that philosophers have not kept up with science. You know, and I think, you know, he's not talking to the right philosophers if he thinks that's the case. Good philosophers do keep up, I think, with the sciences. Ned Block certainly keeps up with the science of that's relevant to consciousness. And they're trying to see what is entailed by the science and what isn't entailed by the science. There are so many different talents that go into this wonderful enterprise of trying to expand our knowledge, trying to be clear about what we know and what we don't know, what scientific theories are answering, what are their implications. There are so many talents in science itself, you know, between the theoreticians and the applied scientists. There's so many different kinds of talents. Philosophical talent is a different kind of talent. And it's part of this very wonderful project of trying to figure out where we are, what we know. Another way of approaching this question is, I'll try this out on you. You know, there are two basic kinds of questions that concern us. One is, what is, you know, what exists? What are the basic ontological categories? And there I do think that science is our best bet. But by and far our best bet. There are also the question of what matters. And I think we care an awful lot about that as well.
I was going to ask you about that, because way back in the mind-body problem, I think, she has a project. Her name was, remind me.
Renee Foyer.
Yes. Has a project where she does what she calls matter mapping.
Yes.
And that turns up in your latest stuff as well.
Yes.
It's something you've been developing over 20 odd years now, I guess.
More like a long time ago.
Very well.
Yes, mattering.
Explain that.
Yes.
Explain the concept of matter mapping.
Actually, the book that I'm working on now might be called The Mattering Map. This was an idea that came out of a fictional character. losing my voice, I'm sorry, I've been talking too much. The way that actually happened, and this is interesting to me. I mean, I think that art, we haven't spoken about fiction and literature,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I think that it too has a role to play in this grand project of ours of trying to figure ourselves out and the world out.
Well, let me just add in there very quickly that through all the things that I've looked back over and the things that we've spoken about before, these two things do come up again. It's the sort of the two cultures debate of the 50s, and then Bronowski's response to it. And here it comes again now, people beginning to start looking at the arts and the humanities. The debate between Steven Pinker, her husband, and Leon Wieseltier about the importance of the humanities. The notion that that what the
whose side do you think I'm on there?
I really don't know. Purpose of an education institution is to shift somebody out and so they can go and get a job and all those sorts of things.
Yes.
These are all difficult debates, but at least it's back on the map again now. I mean,
yeah, but sometimes so unfriendly, so hostile.
Said there's a sea change felt throughout the culture. There's a return to substantive questions. There are artists fascinated with the thinkers pursuing substantive questions. The romance of knowledge.
Where did I say that?
Oh, what are we seeing? What we're seeing now is also more tolerance for being mystified. For recognizing that we sometimes stand scientists too in the presence of questions that are too big for us. We're allowing ourselves to be stunned by immensity and our own cognitive incapacities. That was in Seed. It was the conversation you had with Steve Pinker. But I could go straight to Late Night Thoughts by Lewis Thomas and find a passage in there where he basically is saying that many of the students these days are bewildered. They're baffled as they sit in these classes. But he makes the point, he turns that around and says, as so they should be, and so should their teachers be. Because this is an evolving process, and there's always, the game goes on.
So I think in some sense, a lot of questions have been reopened up, especially these questions about what matters and what is it to live a life that matters, because we are more and more living in a post-theological age. And so for a post-theological age, we are no longer, for many of us, we don't look to religion to answer the question of what it is to live a life that matters. And I know what that feels like, having been brought up in it and having left it. And it is the world feels very different when you believe that that there's a God and you were born because you have a purpose, or you wouldn't have been born, that you are part of this plan, that you matter to the cosmos. It can be really terrifying because, there is that sense that everything that you're doing is watched, and even your thought processes, bad thoughts, are being taken account of and added up. But you never doubt for a moment, as terrifying as it is, you never doubt for a moment that you really matter. You matter to the universe because there is a God, and you matter to God. You know, God cares about whether you're good or bad. It changes the feel of reality and of life dramatically when you don't have that belief anymore, when you don't have that faith anymore. And I think, that has happened, to our society to a very large extent. And so it opens up these questions of what is it to live a life that matter? Do we matter? Ultimately, no, the universe doesn't care, is indifferent. But so creating meaning, creating a life that matters, that this kind of question, these questions about what matters, who matters, do we matter, and questions about what is, they're intimately connected to each other. And when you change your view from a theistic to a non-theistic view, that changes the sense of mattering and how to deal with those problems.
Well, you think that's gone away? I mean, we did Beyond Belief those 3 years. There was huge write-ups all over the place. After 3 years, I thought, well, we've done that. I mean, new atheists versus this, and there's all this philosophical talk.
Yeah, but I think the sort of emotional...
But here we are again with people demanding that we do another one. Here we are with Charlie Hebdo. I mean, what do philosophers say to that sort of thing?
Well, they ought to say a great deal, because I think that this very much lies within the province of philosophy as well, this question of mattering. Of mattering, yeah. So it is a, and I love that word mattering, because, it's ambiguous, right? It's the matter. So we are clumps of matter who really want to matter. And so there's that wonderful ambiguity of it. I have no doubt of the fact that we are material things. Souls are gone, right? But nevertheless, we would like to matter.
You are in love with words, aren't you? Just keep on inventing these words. I do
like words.
The way you tell them about the way you met Steve Pinker. Because that was over a
Which
word.
Which version?
That was over a word.
the true one. Yes, right. So it was over a word. So Steve Pinker was arguing with Stephen Jay Gould in the pages of the New York Review of Books over the validity of evolutionary psychology. Stephen Jay Gould was a very hostile, for political reasons, to evolutionary psychology. And I was following this debate in the New York Review of Books, very, very interested in it all. And in the midst of it, Steven Pinker published a new book. It's one of his lesser-known works.
Was it Stuff of Thought?
No, it was Words and Rules. Do you know that one?
Oh, yeah.
Which is about irregular verbs. Steve loves irregular verbs. He thinks of them as a window into the mind. They function in the stuff of thought a great deal. Anyway, so I ran out to buy the book because I was already very interested in evolutionary psychology. And I first thing I did was look up the went to the index to Gould. I wanted to see if Gould was in there, if Steve Pinker got in any extra swipes against Stephen Jay Gould. But so there was not Gould, but there was Goldstein, Rebecca. It's a very common name. It's a very common name. And it must be another Rebecca Goldstein. But, I looked it up, and it was indeed me. And he quoted my use of an obscure past participle. I used in one of my very obscure novels. I was amazed that he had read it. He was sold about two copies. I had said stridden.
Yeah,
stridden. And he quoted the line, and then he said, some of our finest writers will always use the more obscure past participle, but because it's more poetic and to keep it in play. And it was like, one, wow, he knew who I was. And two, it was a really nice compliment. And
And so there you are. Just
and there
from,
we are. Yeah, the
just
rest
from
is
a
history.
Footnote and stridden. And
stridden,
here
yeah. And we're both, both of us are very obsessed with words. He has a new book out, wonderful new book,
which is
on writing, The Sense of Style. I gave him the title, Nicely Ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
The Sense of Style.
So what are those Paris Review questions? How do you write?
I immerse myself
certain time of day or not? Or?
Well, so I immerse myself in whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Doesn't matter. The process is pretty much the same, except I hear voices when it's fiction. I heard voices with this one, too, because there are the dialogues. So
you heard voices?
You hear the voices. You hear the characters.
Right.
They speak to you. But it stops when
the book is
it stops when the book is done. I have many funny stories about that. It's just complete sort of immersion, obsession. For a long time, a lot of research, once I start writing, my brain's just going to explode because there's just too much in it, that's when I start writing. And then I write obsessively. So when I wrote the incompleteness book, the book about Gödel, I was putting in 18-hour days, and I actually sort of ruined my back by sitting too long. So it's just a complete, I stop eating, I stop sleeping, and I just want to get it out. So I'm a completely undisciplined writer. I just work myself up into such a pitch that then I'm obsessed, and then, you know, most of the time I'm just doing nothing.
There's just one thing I wanted to mention here before we close and go to questions. There's so many little pieces here I could pick on, but when Plato is at the Googleplex,
yeah,
and he's been taught about Google and so on, Marcus, the boy, says that...
he's a software engineer, Marcus.
Mm. And then Cheryl's the other person with him, and they offer Plato the opportunity to go and search a word.
Yes.
On Google.
Yes. So imagine he comes back.
And he says, yeah, Socrates. And he gets 4,700,000 results.
Yes. And right? He does, yes, right. Mm.
So I did it today.
Oh.
And... it's difficult to figure these things out, though. But Socrates actually got 2,900,000.
He's dropping.
Sorry, 21 million.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
21,900,000. Plato, 9,900,000. Spinoza got quite a lot there as well.
Yeah.
But if you then started thinking, well, maybe there's brand names and stuff associated with it. If you put in Plato Greek philosopher,
yes,
it drops to 792,000.
Yes.
So
yes,
that's kind of a problem. I put in Gödel, 570,000. I put in Einstein, just to try a few scientists out, and that was 118 million.
Yeah.
And then I put in Obama, and that was 601 million. Jesus Christ got 190 million. God got 1,230,000,000. Religion got 747 million. And science got 2,260,000,000.
Interesting. Well, I mean, it shows you something.
Not really. I found it immensely amusing for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows what the... I don't know what the algorithm is that actually decides all this sort
no,
of stuff.
No, of course not, yeah.
But at least it looks as though science is still holding up there. So what, we, what
so
we're hoping,
God.
What
so
we're hoping
God.
For then is a rapprochement between science and philosophy. And the explanation of why philosophy won't go away is in this book, Plato at the Googleplex. Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.